Hello, and welcome to our program, Smithsonian, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Margie Lohoff, and during the next half hour, I will be reading articles from Smithsonian's magazine here on OWL Radio. Well, we have quite a variety of topics to cover, as every single issue of this magazine holds. This is just some little briefs from the Ask Smithsonian column from the September 2021 issue. And these are always questions that were submitted by some of the readers and the answers given from someone in one of the myriad parts of Smithsonian Institution. Well, the first question, and I have read this on an earlier program, but who doesn't enjoy a glass of cold beer on a hot summer day or a fruity glass of wine with a nice dinner? Which came first, beer or wine? And this was asked by Catherine Williams of Aptos, California. The earliest evidence leans toward beer, says Teresa McCullough, a curator at the National Museum of American History. Archaeologists found traces of cereal grains on mortars near Haifa, Israel, dated at around 13,000 years old. The previous record belonged to a drink discovered in China dating back 9,000 years. It resembled a mix between beer and grape-based wine. Beer and wine were both relatively straightforward to make, since the sugars in mashed grains or grapes naturally start to ferment when exposed to wild yeasts at the proper temperature. Distilled spirits, such as vodka and whiskey, involve a more complicated understanding of chemistry and likely did not appear until the Middle Ages. And as we know, people have been enjoying them ever since. All right, the next question. At the shore, I see two high tides each day, but the moon is overhead only once a day. What causes the second high tide? And that's a question from Bill Kay in Clifton, Virginia. High tides make the ocean swell twice a day. Once when the moon is overhead, and then again when it's directly on the far side of the Earth, explains Alex Parker, a former postdoctoral fellow at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. The second high tide is a response to the moon's gravity tugging at Earth's orbit. It creates a centrifugal force that can be felt most strongly on the other side of the world. Think about the way a person in the back seat of a car gets pushed against the window as the front of the car suddenly turns. This makes the ocean water spread out and elongate on the far side of the planet about 12 hours after the earlier and stronger high tide. Smaller bodies of water and even the ground beneath us are subject to the same gravitational pulls, but the effects are too tiny for us to notice. Well, that's interesting, and that's not a thought I had ever considered in my visits to the coast. And the last question comes from Steve Baum in Tucson, Arizona. Why did the Big Bang resort in an orderly universe? Don't explosions cause disorder? And the answer is yes. Explosions are disordered, and the Big Bang was like an explosion. But the laws of physics do allow for ordered systems to evolve from disordered ones, says Howard A. Smith, senior astrophysicist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Gravity, in particular, is the cosmic force that brings matter together into more compact, more ordered structures. So there were two answers that came from staff at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. I hope you found those of interest. Well, we're going to move on now to The October 2021 issue of the magazine. And it always starts out with a column that is written by Lonnie G. Bunch III, who is secretary of the Smithsonian. And this one is entitled, Institutional Knowledge, What It Takes. He says a successful secretary must acknowledge the institution's failures as well as successes and celebrate its capacity for change. Interesting statement. Let's see what he has to say about that. In 1978, during graduate school, I headed down to the National Mall to talk to a man about a job at the National Air and Space Museum. I walked into the office of S. Dillon Ripley, knowing very little about the museum world, sporting casual jeans, an afro, and my favorite Army officer jacket with a Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band patch on the sleeve. Imagine my surprise when I walked out that morning with a job offer that would change the trajectory of my career. Decades later, I find myself thinking back to my predecessors and how their efforts, essential, transformative, and even flawed, shape my understanding of the role. Ripley, the eighth secretary, oversaw the institution from 1964 to 1984, a period of rapid expansion at the institution and intense social change in the nation. He led the creation of new museums, research centers, outreach programs, and ventures, including Smithsonian Magazine, an effort close to his heart. He took chances on those who lacked the right experience on paper. Me. He imagined an accessible Smithsonian, one that used its vast repository to serve the needs of the present. In his insistence on the Smithsonian's contemporary relevance, Ripley followed the model set over a century earlier by the Smithsonian's first secretary, Joseph Henry. An eminent scientist and inventor in the early 1800s, Henry believed in the Smithsonian's responsibility to the nation and its citizens. The worth and importance of the institution is to be estimated by what it sends forth to the world, he wrote. Henry was a visionary who enabled the vast and vital Smithsonian we know today. He was also a scientific racist who believed in the biological inferiority of black people and barred abolitionists like Frederick Douglass from speaking at the institution. As the first historian in the role of secretary, I know that the past is too complex to lionize or excoriate my predecessors. Doing this job well means acknowledging the institution's successes and failures and celebrating its capacity for change. Only by recognizing the ways in which this institution and its leaders both lived up to and fell short of their own standards can we become the Smithsonian of Henry's and Ripley's highest aspirations. A place of accessibility, of innovation, of relevance and richness, and of meaning. As we reflect on 175 years of history, our great strength is our willingness to engage fully with our past, build on our achievements, and evolve to meet the lofty goals we have always set for ourselves. Interesting perception of the current secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, Lonnie Bunch. Well, in the prologue section of here, there are articles on a lot of different subjects. As I mentioned before, so the first one we're going to start off with is an American icon. It is entitled, Climate Change Itself Won't Affect Weather Modeling Because the Time Scales Are Vastly Different. That's the subtitle. For centuries, humans complained about the weather. In 1848, the Smithsonian Institution decided to do something about it. Weather conditions had been considered to be either God's will or explainable only by homespun nostrums like clear moon, frost soon, or by observing, say, the behavior of ants, which don't like rain. The Farmer's Almanac promised readers more accurate forecasts when it debuted in 1818, but even those predictions were determined by a, quote, secret formula, and still are. Joseph Henry, the first secretary of the Smithsonian, tried something new, crowdsourcing. That's a phrase that's current today. The institution handed out weather monitoring equipment such as thermometers, barometers, and rain gauges to 150 volunteer observers across the country. Each day, their localized reports arrived by telegraph, and the Smithsonian generated a national weather map that it displayed on the National Mall. The map became a popular attraction. Tourists who viewed it, Henry noted, appear to be specially interested in knowing the condition of weather to which their friends at home are subjected at the time. And doesn't that sound familiar? Whenever we travel, we're wondering if we're getting any rain back there, or if it's roasting hot and we forgot to put some of the plants in the shade. It goes on, an amusing novelty, but no consolation for those pioneers crossing North America, the continent with some of the most violent weather on Earth. Only 2 years before, 42 members of the Donner Party perished in an early Sierra Nevada snowfall they had no way of foreseeing. In time, the number of Smithsonian volunteers grew to more than 600. Technology improved, and slowly, auditors found ways of determining what rudimentary climate data collected from about the skies over Denver might soon mean to the skies over Chicago and New York as weather moved east. Reports about temperature, humidity, wind and cloud formations flooded in. Still, data didn't always reach the right place at the right time. For example, on the Great Lakes, 97 ships were lost in 1 4-day gale in 1869. In the year following that tragedy, President Ulysses S. Grant signed a resolution into law creating the Division of Telegrams and Reports for the benefit of commerce. The Smithsonian's weather observation network was turned over to the Army, which began issuing official forecasts capable of seeing, if hazily, 24 hours ahead. The threat from sudden weather disasters diminished. Shipborne commerce vastly improved. Doing business in America increasingly meant knowing the weather ahead. The division would evolve into the National Weather Service, part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, in the Commerce Department. The first U.S. weather balloons took flight in 1909, improving the study of temperature, humidity, and air pressure. Another breakthrough came in the 1920s, when the balloons were equipped with radio transmitters, and real-time observation of the stratosphere became possible. For the first time, researchers observed not only the width of a weather system, but also its height. During World War II, radar operators noticed patterns of interference on their screens aligned with heavy weather, and the science of radar meteorology took off and is still in use today. So confident were some mid-20th century weather mavens that they speculated the heavens could be manipulated by chemically altering the atmosphere. Bespoke weather, they believed, would bring rain to farmlands, snow to ski resorts. That quixotic dream didn't pan out, however, and Americans today are delighted to settle for smartphone weather apps powered by NWS, the National Weather Service, computer and satellite data, that give accurate information they can access instantly to stay safe. The average 3-day hurricane landfall forecast can now pinpoint a much more specific swath of at-risk coastline, 100 miles in 2020, compared with 300 miles in 1990, reducing the stress and cost of false alarms. Over the same period, the average tornado warning time has risen from 5 minutes to 8 to 10 minutes. Will climate change erode our confidence in everyday weather predictions? Not in the short term, says Beth Carpenter, a meteorologist and co-founder of Thermodynamic Solutions, an Indianapolis-based firm. Climate change itself won't affect weather modeling because the time scales are vastly different. We are forecasting on a much smaller time scale, usually only 1 to 3 months at a time, for seasonal forecasts at the longest range. Climate periods are defined as average conditions over 30 years. North America's weather is no less violent than it was when the Donner Party, oblivious, set sail in their prairie schooners, covered wagons, before succumbing, victims of what Joseph Henry would call the problem of American storms. But the National Weather Service, now with 4,000 workers, will keep finding safer ways for us to live with them. That's a sunny forecast, no matter where you are. That's very interesting to consider, since one of our favorites even today is to complain about the weather or to wonder about the weather. It's not new today. As you can see, it's been going on for centuries, actually, and yet we have tools in place today that give us more warning of severe weather and give us more time to prepare. Some ingenious methods for getting a fix on atmospheric conditions and even the Earth's crusts, and this is a small article that ends this bigger one, and this is by Shi N. Kim. The big picture. An early meteorograph is a device that combines and charts numerous variables at once, such as temperature, precipitation, and barometric pressure. And then there's a ceiling fixture. Meteorologists employed a spotlight and theodolite, like scope surveyors use, to measure the height of cloud cover. The value was derived by triangulating the light source, the reflection on the ceiling, and a fixed object nearby. And then the white stuff. A snow gauge in the Northwest in 1917 had a quantity of snow collected over a given time span, which was melted then, and the water volume indicated the depth of the snow cover. That seems pretty rudimentary. Up and up is what they called a helium or hydrogen-filled pilot balloon around 1943. It rose at a predictable rate. It measured wind speed and direction, as well as cloud altitude. And that seems like something that might have been used in advance of some of the battles in World War II. And then precipitation situation. Reading a rain gauge, and of course we, many of us, still use rain gauges today in our yards, but reading a rain gauge in the 1920s, had the ancients kept track of rainfall, but 17th century Englishman Richard Townley was known for his systematic measurements, noting how little trouble there is to this task. And I guess that's the same today. If we set out a rain gauge and let the rain fill it up, it tells us roughly how much has fallen. And finally, earth shaking. In the early 20th century seismograph, a pendulum weight suspended at the end of the horizontal bar responded proportionately to an earthquake and marked the rotating disk. Well, that is a lot about weather as it was known in the decades back. So we still may be wondering and think that weathermen have shoot-in-the-dark kind of method of predicting, and sometimes it seems that way when it changes and it doesn't match up with what they have predicted. But there are far more tools available to them, at least today, to make it a little more accurate than it would have been back in the day. And I'm sure more still to come in the future. Well, the next little article is art. Quite a swing from the weather. Material Witness, and this is written by Amy Crawford. For historians, quilts are much more than just decorative covers for a bed. In 1812, Catherine Paul moved from Greenwich, Massachusetts, with her husband William, their four sons, and William's widowed mother, to the frontier town of Solon in what would become the state of Maine. There, Catherine sewed a quilt, embroidering it with images of family members and the tower of the town meeting house. It's part of a new show which opens this month, October, well, we're into November almost now, at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. This show consists of 58 quilts and bed covers spanning 400 years of U.S. history, including masterpieces by African American artisans in the rural South, tributes to Civil War soldiers and the Transcontinental Railroad, and modern works that push boundaries both aesthetic and political. Often patched together from myriad scraps of fabric, quilts have long offered an easy metaphor for the diversity of a sprawling nation. But curator Jennifer Swope argues they can tell plenty of other stories about culture, community, and the power of remembrance. Quilts, she says, bear witness. Interesting approach to think of quilts. And in the picture of the one quilt that they talked about in 1812 that Catherine Paul made, there are stitched images of different people on horseback. There are some that look more like a portrait inside, looking from the side of the person. There are some little animals. It looks like it might be a little covey of quail. And there are some owls. And just there's a horse by itself without a rider. There is the tower with a moon beyond it that was mentioned in the article. A lot of work and a lot of skill took place in the creation of this quilt that now, several hundred years later, can be enjoyed with the show going on at the museum in Boston. Well, this next article is under the category of education, and it's entitled Play the Past. And I'm looking to see who the author is, but it doesn't... Oh, Ted Scheinman. That's what it is. Okay, class, for tonight's history homework, you'll be playing Assassin's Creed. What might sound like a slacker's dream assignment is finding new respect in academia, spurred on by a University of Kansas historian who says video games are crucial to the, quote, creation of public knowledge of the past and belong in the classroom. It's an interesting take to think of video games being encouraged, where generally teachers and parents are trying to discourage video games because they think that it's wasting their students' times. Well, Andrew Denning, an associate professor, notes that the increasing sophistication of history-based titles and the growing number of scholars who grew up on video games, Denning, age 38, is one, are softening higher education's distrust of the activity. A University of Tennessee course centers on the Red Dead Redemption series, wherein players explore turn-of-the-century America. The level of detail relayed by a game far outstrips that of a historical monograph, Denning argues in a recent paper published in the American Historical Review. Some game companies are now striving for maximal accuracy, even hiring historian consultants. The new edition of Oregon Trail has referred to scholars of Native America, Denning tells me. And here are six other games that may find their way onto a syllabus. The first is Assassin's Creed by Ubisoft. This action-adventure series, set in various epochs from ancient Greece to 19th century London, presents players with historical scenarios and even science fiction, but is almost unrivaled in its world-building. Players explore rich representations of architecture as though walking through real-world heritage sites. The Discovery Mode offers tours curated by historians and archaeologists. The next one is Attentat 1942 by Charles Gaines. This explicitly educational game depicts Czech lands under Nazi occupation. Animations of the past and conversations with actors in the present enrich the narrative experience as players ask elderly characters to recount their memories of wartime. This style of storytelling reveals how personal and collective histories are intertwined in any historical conflict. The next is Crusader Kings by Paradox Development Studio. In this complex grand strategy game, players rule a medieval dynasty through tactical choices, forging alliances by arranging marriages, say, and experiment with counterfactual history. What if Wales had colonized England, for example, instead of the other way around? By imagining a different outcome, such scenarios can help us better understand what did happen in the past by considering what did not. And Battlefield, in recent visions of this first-person shooter series, players can explore the two world wars from many perspectives, such as that of the Italian Arditi of World War I. Other similar games generally focus only on American, British, or Soviet operations. The latest versions also highlight the roles of women and people of color in the conflicts, roles often overlooked in histories of the wars. And the other two, one is called 1979 Revolution, Black Friday, and it talks about the Iranian Revolution and offers players choices that evoke the moral ambiguities of this upheaval. Players encounter history through archival photographs and video footage, adding realism to the gaming experience. The game also acknowledges the British and U.S.-sponsored 1953 coup, an episode often missing in Western accounts of the Revolution. And finally, Brothers in Arms by Gearbox Software, a first- or third-person shooter game often seen as a crass diversion, can also offer cinematic depictions of historical drama. This one presents players with tactical challenges from World War II, such as maneuvering infantry to flank and suppress enemy units. While the game's lessons about period combat are relatively basic, they show the positive of immersive styles of learning through reenactment. What an interesting approach to gaming and making it more valuable by adding in studies by historians and archaeologists on all different aspects of history. And I can see why students might really gravitate toward it and thereby learn even better the subject matter that is involved in each of those. That's a very interesting progression. Well, that's all we have time for today. You've been listening to Smithsonian on OWL Radio. You can listen to OWL Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Margie Lohoff saying goodbye from OWL Radio.